Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behind the badge.
Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
Well, there's never a dull moment during the Trump administration, obviously. Constant news, constant happenings. And as of late, perhaps the first significant scandal-looking kind of occurrence. We'll see, and we'll see how it all shapes up. But we want to take a look at that and other events on the Trump administration calendar. Joining me is Democratic strategist Richard Gordon, who has worked with, he's been in this business for almost 30 years, working with Senate candidates and all sorts of great people around the country. But I want to get his insight as to what's going on here. Richard, you're a frequent guest on Politics Tonight. Thank you for joining the podcast.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, the news of recent day, of course, happens to be the resignation of General Mike Flynn, the National Security Advisor, as it became clear through Washington Post reporting and other sources that perhaps maybe he did have a conversation about the sanctions with his Russian counterparts, perhaps prior or post to the election. And President Trump lost faith in him, felt he couldn't trust him, so he had to ask for his resignation. Sean Spicer held a press conference in which he said, you know, this just, there are no legal problems here, no legal issues. This isn't about what he talked about. This is nothing more than a loss of trust in the National Security Advisor. Is that a spin, or is it your take on where things are?
Well, it's clearly a spin. I mean, let's start with the most obvious thing. You cannot lie to your boss. I don't care what job you have, but when your boss happens to be the President of the United States and the Vice President of the United States, you can't lie to them and you can't cover up your mistakes. You have to be honest and clear and direct, and you got to fall on the sword and say what you did and say what you didn't do. So that's the first thing. Lying to Mike Pence, letting Mike Pence go on national television and saying, no, this never happened, that's a huge mistake. So he had to go because of that. As far as the legality of the whole thing, I mean, from everything I have heard, he is in violation of the law. Will they enforce it? Will he be indicted? Those type of issues. Most legal scholars I've listened to over the last couple of days have said no. But it is something that he did that violated the law, period, end of story. However, is that the real reason he's gone? I got to believe, had it not been for him lying to the vice president, that he'd still be there today.
So, well, and you just had a fact kind of assumed in there that he did lie to the vice president. There's been some indication, you know, Trump didn't know, Pence didn't know, or he lied to the vice president. What do you think the possibilities? I mean, you look at how this would have played out, which is that, especially when this started to come to light, when the Justice Department, or Intel, mm-hmm. found out what was going on. They told the Justice Department. The Justice Department informed the White House. And clearly, for a period of at least of weeks, whether or not the president or vice president knew ahead of time, it seems that there has to be more known at the top than they're admitting to, or so it would seem. It just doesn't seem practical that once Justice told White House counsel, the president, the vice president would have been kept in the dark, and yet nothing happened for the next several weeks.
Yeah, that's almost impossible to believe. I mean, the way most of these offices work, whether it's a president's office or a governor's office, a call to the counsel like that would immediately be acted upon, and the president and or the vice president would have been informed. It is almost impossible to believe that didn't happen. It is possible that the counsel spoke to the chief of staff, and the chief of staff didn't do anything with it. Is that within the realm of possibility? Sure. It would be a natural thing for counsel to go to the chief and have that discussion. But also, I have to believe that before Vice President-elect Pence went on national television on January 15th, that he was briefed about what people have done, and that he knew that Flynn had spoken about issues but had not spoken about anything confidential. I have to believe that he possibly even called him or in his briefings and asked him. It's hard to believe that the vice president elect at that time would go on national television and not completely understand the issue. And if he didn't, that, especially knowing Mike Pence, that if he didn't know the answer, that he didn't simply say, you know, I don't know if that happened or not, but to categorically deny it leads me to believe he was told.
You also had President Trump on Air Force One just prior to this whole story blowing up. And when he was asked, hey, what about this Flynn thing? What's going on? And Trump said, what? What are you talking about? I'll have to read those reports. I'm wondering whether you have trouble believing that, because nobody seems to be more in touch with what television and newspaper coverage is putting forth on a daily and hourly basis than President Trump.
Well, I think for us basketball fans, I think that's called the four corners, you know, where you just stall to get more time. Yeah, I find it hard to believe also. I have a feeling, look, one of two things happened. Either the president was not forthcoming with the media on the plane, or, which could be a systemic problem, is information not getting to the president? Are they keeping information from him? And that is very serious. And if that's the case, if the president doesn't know about specific issues because his staff is afraid of him, doesn't want to tell him bad news, whatever, we have a real serious problem. That has to be corrected.
There's a famous phrase, depending on the age of our listeners, those who remember Watergate will remember the famous phrase from Howard Baker, which is, what did the president know and when did he know it? We're hearing those questions asked again currently by Democrats anyway. And it raises the question, you are a Democratic strategist, so we got to put that out there as saying your answer will be tainted accordingly. But the question is, do you think even back when Flynn was making these phone calls, having these conversations with his Russian ambassador counterpart, so to speak, did he take it upon himself to just say, okay, hey, whatever, we don't know what he said, but if it was something along the lines of don't worry about those sanctions, we'll address the sanctions, whatever it was, do you have any question about the fact that that would have been done without direction from or knowledge of the president to be?
You know, you've really touched the major point here. I've been thinking about that since last night. It's almost incomprehensible to me that someone who is about to assume a job like that would not talk to his boss about it before he did it. It just seems hard to believe that that he wouldn't have checked with him and said, hey, look, I'm thinking of calling, you know, the Russian ambassador, you know, this is what I'm going to say. Or I wonder if he was ordered to call the Russian ambassador. The bottom line is we just don't know. And yes, maybe my viewpoint is a little tainted, but I would like to think I'm being objective. I think the question for the Congress is, did the president-elect order Mr. Flynn to make this communication? That's the question I want an answer to, and I'd like to see Flynn under oath answer that question, because I think that's critical to this whole analysis and understanding what really happened.
Most people, of course, you know, if you're going to work for the president, you're very loyal to the president. Do you ever think that would – and I understand they might put him under oath, but the truth is, unless it was done over some recorded phone conversation, mm-hmm. why would – General Flynn ever come out and say that, which is say, yes, I was ordered to do so by the president, unless he harbors some kind of resentment towards having to step down and wants to take everybody with him. And if he did say that it was said by the president, he'd be accused of simply wanting to take everybody with him.
Well, we could always ask the Russians, because they probably taped every conversation.
Well, they said nothing, of course, but the Russians did speak to this. They said we never discussed sanctions. None of that ever occurred, which right there is evidence that it probably did.
Probably did, but they're probably taping everyone's cell phones anyway. He's a general, he should fall on the sword and whatnot. You know, people react differently when they're put under oath. As we saw in the Watergate hearings, people suddenly found religion and were honest. And would he do that? I don't know, but it sure is a question I think Congress has a responsibility to ask.
In a press conference conducted by Democrats, I think it was Representative Conyers, made the point that it may have been somebody else, but who made the point that Flynn had tweeted today that essentially he was a scapegoat. Now, I went to look at the tweets, and there is a couple of tweets about being a scapegoat, but then other people are saying this is a fake account, it's not Flynn, and so I don't know whether he said it or not. I'm inclined to believe maybe he didn't. I don't know if he would have submitted that and then the next morning would have said, I'm a scapegoat.
Yeah, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt on this one. It seems unlikely. I did read his resignation letter, and it was gracious. And look, who knows on these things? There's so many fake things going on. I did find it very interesting. I mean, you talk about the White House left hand, right hand, not knowing what each other is doing. You know, you have Kellyanne Conway saying that the president has every confidence in him. Then an hour later, you have the press secretary, Sean Spicer, saying, you know, he's evaluating the situation, the president is. You know, what happened in that hour? Was there did something change in the White House?
Well, my sense of it is, I don't think anything did, but don't you think these are now the signs of an inexperienced White House? You know, the you have nobody up there who has ever been part of an administration or a government, nobody who can say, here's how you handle these things.
Right.
So they all seem to be sort of short-term, well, we'll say that works for now, not realizing that 3 hours later, when it no longer is true, you're going to have to explain yourself. I just think it's a lack of experience, don't you?
I think that's quite possibly true. I think this White House is unusually lacking in experience. And I think because of that, I think we're going to see a lot of changes over the next couple of weeks to months. I think the president has experimented with having certain people in certain jobs, and it's obviously not working. And, you know, recently we saw Chris Ruddy, a close personal friend of the president, taking a shot at Chief of Staff Priebus,
right,
which is
stunning. And then backing off.
Yes, but you have to think that he wasn't out there on his own. And look, things that are going on in the White House now should not be happening. The rollout on the immigration ban was an absolute disaster. The getting people confirmed to cabinet positions has taken forever. Partly the Democrats' fault, of course, but partly because the Republicans aren't well organized either. There are a lot of issues going on in this White House, and I think at some point in the very near future, I think the president will come to terms with that and start putting people in who maybe are more seasoned. I think they need an adult in the White House. I think they need somebody in the White House who's been in Washington, who understands Washington, who gets how Congress works, who gets the agencies. I mean, it's great to want to drain the swamp, but you got to know where the mosquitoes are, you know? You have to know where the bodies are, where the people are, the people who need to be spoken with, because things in Washington just don't happen organically like that. It takes a lot of work. They need someone in the White House who could direct the trains and make sure things run on time.
Did you get a sense the president helped himself by sending Stephen Miller out to all the Sunday morning talk shows last week when, you know, I mean, he almost seemed like he was to the right of Stephen Bannon, if that's even possible. You know, the president's power will not be questioned, kind of a thing. I found that terrifying.
You know, I actually watched it on a couple different channels. I was watching it and I was stunned to see that he was on every single channel. I think part of the problem is he's just a scary person, and I think he doesn't instill confidence in people out there. I think some of the language they are using needs to be toned down. I think people need to explain to them that the American people don't like bellicose language like that, in-your-face type of language, that it might have worked on the campaign, but it doesn't work here. It also doesn't work coming from someone who is so incredibly inexperienced as he is, who's also extremely young. People don't look at him with, especially congressional leaders, don't look at him with a sense of confidence that he knows what he's talking about. I think a lot of people found it offensive.
And yet when he was done, the president tweets, "Great job. You represented me well, Stephen Miller." So all that he did say, which he came under a fair amount of attack for, apparently done with the blessing of the president.
Well, look, no one goes on Sunday morning talk shows without being coached in what to say, you know, and how to say it and what the message is and what the point they're trying to get out. So I think he was saying what the White House wanted him to say. I just think over a period of time, and I don't know how long that'll be, maybe it'll be months, this White House will understand that the American people do not appreciate that type of language and being treated this way and having things put in their face constantly. And I think when that happens, you will see a lot of changes at the White House, both in tone, in message, and ultimately in personnel.
Just a general sense from you as we wrap things up. It appears to be the first real scandal. Does this have legs? Are we talking about this a month or 2 months from now? Or does this thing kind of fade away and we've shifted to something else? Because nobody's better at changing the dialogue in the media and the public than President Trump.
Yes, he is clearly the master. But I'll tell you, this is different. In politics, whenever you do something that goes to a core view of the public, whether someone you think isn't terribly bright and they do something that's not too intelligent, et cetera, it has legs. This has legs not because of Michael Flynn, not because they've cut him out and exercised him and got him out of government. That story doesn't have much. What does have much is what is going on between this president, this administration, and Russia. If this had to do with something else, if this was a conversation with another government on a different issue, Israel, China, whatever, even a very hot issue, it would go away. The fact that it's about Russia makes it important and will make Republican leaders in the Senate, like John McCain, sit up and notice. That's why this thing will be, we will be talking about this for months to come. And I think that's the reason.
Well, and you need the John McCain because, I mean, the immediate response from Democrats, including Jason Chaffetz, who was supposed to head this whole ethics oversight thing, was nothing to see here. Flynn's gone. Let's move on. And you got to wonder, if this were President Hillary Clinton, if this were Barack Obama.
Oh, please.
the last thing they'd be saying is, let's move on.
I think the thing they'd be saying would be lock her up, because I think that seems to be their mantra, and I think that was Michael Flynn's mantra. But, yes, I agree. There's a tremendous double standard here. Look, the congressional Democrats are obviously in a tremendously weakened state. There's just a limit to what they can do. But hopefully the Senate will react differently. And I think as things start coming out, if there is a true connection, more and more truth comes out about Russia and this administration's connection to Russia, the voter scandal, et cetera, I think people will pay attention. I think senators will be forced to pay attention.
Richard Gordon, Democratic strategist, thanks for visiting with me. And come back in the future as we watch how this plays out for a while. And let's talk about it again and probably other things going on.
I look forward to it. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. What great fun music. That is from a musical called The Scottsboro Boys. You may have heard of it, perhaps not. It did play in New York, but not for a very long time. But it's a show you should know about because it's experiencing its Chicago premiere at the Porchlight Music Theater here in Chicago. And it is Candor and Ebb. You know Candor and Ebb, right? Cabaret in Chicago and Kiss of the Spider Woman. It was their final collaboration, but with a powerful message and powerfully presented, as everything Porchlight Music Theater does, is presented. And so we wanted to chat about that show just a bit. Joining me to talk about the Scottsboro Boys is the director of the show, Samuel Roberson Jr. This show is his debut with Porchlight Music Theater. He himself, an accomplished actor. I've seen him on stage in a variety of things, including the Ballad of Emmett Till at the Goodman Theater, Civil War Christmas at Northlight. So many wonderful shows. He joins us. Sam, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And also joining us is the man of vision for the Porchlight Music Theater. It's artistic director Michael Weber returns to the podcast, as we had him on earlier to talk about the upcoming season. Now we get to talk about a specific show. Welcome back, Michael.
Hi, Paul. Thank you.
So let me start, Samuel, with you, which is Scottsboro Boys did not get a long play on Broadway. I want you to tell me a little bit about the plot of this show, and in so doing, explain to me, was this just a plot too uncomfortable for Broadway audiences?
So the Scottsboro Boys explores the trial of nine young men who were falsely accused of rape back in 1931, who ended up in prison and sentenced to death because of a lie told by a couple of young women at the time. And so the content of the play isn't your typical fun-loving musical theater piece. So I believe that, the content had something to do with it. I think that where we were as a people had something to do with it. And it's hard to get somebody to come out and say, hey, come watch this wonderful musical by Candor and Ebb that's set in the minstrel show form and talks about how these nine young men were treated very poorly.
And Michael, you, of course, part of the critical decision to have Porchlight Music Theater present this show. So tell me a little bit about what was behind that decision. Why did you feel it was important that this play a role during the season?
Well, I have been familiar with the show since its original Broadway debut back in 2010, and it was really surprising to me that it had not been yet presented in Chicago, which is, of course, a very sophisticated theater town that is usually interested in unusual works and works that ask a lot of tough questions. You bring up Candor and Ebb, and I think that really what is important to remember about what the kind of shows that we think of with Candor and Ebb, specifically pieces like Cabaret or Chicago, at the heart of both of those musicals are some very tough subject matter. Cabaret is about the rise of the Nazis in Weimar Germany. Chicago, which is based on a true story that happened here in Chicago back in the 20s, is about two women who basically murdered their husbands and or lovers and then used America's fascination with the media and celebrity to kind of gloss over their really pretty heinous acts that they did. Candor and Ebb have a real talent for taking challenging adult material and giving you an entertaining way into the story while also leaving you with a very powerful message. And Scottsboro Boys certainly has all of those same qualities that make the best of the Candor and Ebb musicals the kind of shows that have become audience favorites, even though they may not really like stop and immediately think, well, what was that show about? And Scottsboro Boys, you know, fits right into that mold.
And let's acknowledge it did get nominated for 12 Tony Awards it was up. So it was not as though this was not a recognized show. It certainly was. Sam, in terms of the casting in this show, Larry Yendo is one of my favorite actors in Chicago. Listeners certainly know him. If for nothing else, you know him for Christmas Carol over at the Goodman Theater, which he's done for several years. But he also played an incredible Roy Cohn over at the Court Theater. I mean, he's just done some incredible stuff. He's cast here playing the interlocutor, and also he plays some other roles during the show, as so many of the cast members do, like a judge, the governor of Alabama. Talk to me about the power of Larry. I want to just take a moment for him. Talk to me about the power of having a guy like Larry Yendo in the cast.
Absolutely. I mean, Larry is an absolute delight, and he brings so much knowledge to the table and experience that for me in my debut at Porchlight, it's just very helpful to have him in the room to kind of lead the way and show through his experience and his professionalism how to handle such a complicated piece, you know. And he is just a force of nature that, you know, you can't help but pay attention to him. And him as the interlocutor who is kind of running the show, who is the master of ceremonies, you know, it'd only be right to have him, you know, in this show, in this place, especially at this time, to kind of show off another side of him, or I don't know, the multiple facets that he can provide when being in a show. And I think Larry was just really excited to be in the room. We have a lot of young people in this cast. There's a lot of people coming straight out of college, and so for him to be able to be in that room and be a mentor and be a guide and also be able to wrestle with this material, I think was great for him and great for all of us in the room. It's always great to have Larry in the room.
Indeed. And by the way, Sam, I'll stick with you for this next question. I mean, it's an ensemble cast, so they're doing some great stuff, but just some real, to me, James Earl Jones Jr., a true standout in the show. I happen to be a huge fan of Mark Hood, who listeners may remember from The Voice. He was the guy that, although he did not win it, the judges called him back as their favorite and wanted him to do it again, and his energy is so great on the stage. But the entire cast, talk to me about what it was like as a director working with the, you got to keep them looking like an ensemble, right? You have some real standout talents, but they all play together.
Absolutely. One of the things that, I was so happy that James agreed to the show. We were so happy to have him because he's such a talent. But to see him in a role like Haywood is just, it's uncanny what he's doing on that stage. And I really wanted to make sure that we got the feel of the youth in this production because, seeing a bunch of grown men on that stage, I'm not sure allows for as much empathy as we want from our audiences. And so one of the keys during a lot of the conversations that we would have in rehearsal was just talking about honoring the nine young men that were mistreated in this trial. And so each and every, actor and each and every person in the ensemble, we really talked about their character and what they were bringing to the table and to the production and to the stage, and how they could, you know, how they are the ones who are honoring these boys. So, you know, if Isaiah is playing Willie Roberson, like, you are the only one who can honor Willie Roberson. Nobody else on this stage can do that. Only you can. And so as they understood that, they began to understand that this is about all of us. Even though, you know, Haywood is so highlighted in the show, they understood that they each have a responsibility to each of their characters, as opposed to just the whole, the story as a whole.
Michael, you, of course, as the artistic director for Porchlight Music Theater, you know, guide all that goes on there. And just to remind people, I mean, this is the theater that did Dreamgirls and End of the Rainbow and just so many incredible shows, and always a powerful show. In the Heights, by the way, which probably could have played forever if you didn't have to kind of move away from the space. But it was amazing. But so talk for me a little bit. When you bring in a director like Sam, and this was his, you know, his debut here, what do you tell? Put us in the room where it happens, so to speak, from Hamilton. Talk to me about what you tell a director who's going to guide through your vision sometimes a new show to what it means to produce something for Porchlight.
Well, in some ways it isn't, and especially with somebody like Sam, who really has a very strong vision as a director, but also a very strong political opinion and a very strong political mind in terms of what he wanted to say with the piece. Sam, for maybe your listeners who don't know, is also the artistic director of Chicago's Congo Square Theater, which is one of our finest
Yes.
theaters working in town right now. And they specialize in stories of the African-American experience. To interview Sam after basically giving him the material to kind of read over and digest, and then come in and just sit down and say, what would you like to do with this? What would you like to say with this? Sam basically told me how the show was going to go and what was important to him as a director, who saw in the material something that could be said, because unfortunately it still needs to be said in an era of many of the stories that we see on the news, of a lot of encounters that some of our young black men in Chicago have with authority figures, with the police, with the way that their situations that they find themselves in are manipulated to paint a story about them that is not true. This is a tale that in this particular case goes back to 1931, but it is still absolutely resonant today. That was the kind of thing that was very important to Sam and the other members of his artistic team, to make sure that the audience isn't just seeing a story of history, but seeing something that is a musical that needs to leave the audience with something to think about today and how they are seeing it. It's not often that you have musicals that are about true moments in history, and certainly these nine Scott boys who became known as the Scottsboro Boys are there in our collective memory because people are choosing to keep the story alive. But there are so many hundreds and thousands of young men around the country since 1931 who didn't have a story told, who certainly didn't have a Broadway musical written about them, and they have been lost to the vagaries of history, and how many of them have, like Haywood Patterson, just died in jail without anybody ever knowing their story. Haywood took it upon himself to write it down and get the story out, and as we know in history, this was the story eventually got out there to Rosa Parks, where she was aware of his story, and I think it was influential on her and the decisions that she made that affected the world in her life. So in terms of Sam's effect on the show as a director, it was just quite the opposite. Not what I wanted to tell Sam that I wanted him to do, but what Sam told me that he wanted to do with it. And that's why I think we have this incredibly powerful production that's been getting standing ovations every single performance since the first preview of it. So it's really the power of what Sam was able to do with the material.
Very well put. And indeed, Rosa Parks, I don't know, you know, I don't mean to give away things one shouldn't give away, but we'll say she does play a role in this show as well. And but you just raised an interesting question. So I guess Sam is a director. Either of you can answer this. But what Michael just talked about, the fact that the message of Scottsboro Boys resonates so strongly, especially here in the city of Chicago, with all of the continued violence and issues between young black men and police officers and whatnot, and the system, we will say. You absolutely pay homage to history. We see the faces of the actual men that were involved in this. They're put up on the wall. We see that at the end. And so it's a very powerful moment. But I'm just curious, as a director's note, are those components, putting up those pictures, for example, is that a director's call? Is that in the script originally? And or if you did want to make the tie to today's, you know, or not even just Chicago, but today's situations, a Laquan McDonald or an Eric Garner or whatever, would it be appropriate for the director to, with photos, some other way, make that connection? Or can you not do that when you're putting on a show written, in this case, by, you know, Kendra Knepp? Does that make sense? You get my question?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a little bit of both. So, you know, you really want to honor what's on the page. I mean, it's Kendra Knepp. They know what they're doing. So you really want to make sure first that you're honoring what's on the page. But then as a director, you also have your own vision, which is why people like the greats like Kendra Knepp create the material, is for someone to take it and then interpret it and show it through their eyes or through their lens. And so, you know, as for the nine boys, is it in the script to show their faces? No. But I thought it was really important to see the faces and understand who we're honoring as a cast and as a production team and as Porchlight. You know, we really wanted to make sure that we're honoring, you know, these nine young men, which, you know, Michael was very honest about. You know, this is why Porchlight wants to tell the important stories. They want to tell the truth, if you will, which Haywood says in the show, and, you know, allowing me to have certain things happen, like connecting to today, like showing the boys' faces, is a part of that process. Because we want our audiences, like Michael said, to leave different than when they came. We want them to leave asking questions, to be having discussions on the car rides home. We don't want them to just run out of the lobby and run home. We want them to have these conversations so that we can think differently and we can begin to, you know, see things in a different light and empathize and sympathize with those who are being oppressed by any sorts and kinds of supremacy.
One of the things too, Paul, you know, when the show was on Broadway in 2010, that was to some degree a bit before the curve of the amounts of sort of cell phone video and a number of these incidences being pointed out in a very naked way that have been happening within the last couple of years. I don't know that the show necessarily was being connected to specific incidences back in 2010 as it really powerfully is today. An audience can't walk out of this show and not make a connection to modern events that are happening, and specifically to names of people, you know, living or recently died within the last 2 years. So I think that the play, to some degree, was a little bit almost ahead of its time when it was originally seen by audiences in 2010.
But perfect for audiences today. Scottsboro Boys playing over at the Porchlight Music Theater on Belmont. And now let me ask you, Michael, it's scheduled to close on March 12th. Will there be an extension as we talk right now? Because this people will be listening to this podcast beyond that.
As of right now, this is a limited run, and it will be closing on the 12th, so you do need to get your tickets now to get over to see it. It is selling very well, and but it will have a limited run here at Porchlight.
Well, as I said, even in the Heights, which I told the world to go see, it was just tough to get a ticket. You guys do great stuff, and so you don't want to wait. You can go to the website, porchlightmusictheater.org, and theater is spelled the proper way, T-R-E, at the end. That's the British version, as far as I'm concerned. And the way to spell theater, porchlightmusictheater.org. Samuel Roberson Jr., phenomenal direction of a really incredible and important show. And Michael Weber, the artistic director for Porchlight Music Theater, thanks for selecting it for the season. And come back, Michael, because we'll have to talk about the fact that next season Porchlight is going to move to a new location for the season, right?
We're going to be having a new home. We'll be over at the wonderful Ruth Page Theater that's in the Gold Coast.
Talk about that down the line. That's not now. For now, okay. It's over on Broadway. You don't want to miss over on the Belmont. You don't want to miss that. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Don't miss Scottsboro Boys, Porchlight Music Theater through March 12th at Stage 773.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.